This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen, alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. Five times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you into the 8 o'clock hour we go. Text page, Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line, 713-572-4610 if you want to weigh in on anything that we've been discussing this morning. Derek Stingley Jr. signed his big deal this week, met with the media on Wednesday. Shortly after that, he sat down with John Harris and Mark Vandermeer on Texans All Access. Really good conversation. You can find it. I'm guessing it's up on YouTube, but you can certainly find it at HoustonTexans.com. Good. It's up
I apologize. Yeah. Never mind.
Oh, okay. Is it up on
usually
YouTube?
It is. I was thinking about the press conference itself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, usually Texans All Access is up on YouTube.
Yeah, usually it is. Yeah. You can go find it. It's a good full conversation. Here was Derek Stingley Jr. talking about setting the standard here in Houston.
Well, really, like you said, Nico was already here doing all that. So, like, that standard is already set. So, I mean, I was just trying to keep up with how things operate around here. And hopefully more people just do that on a consistent basis.
Hopefully more people.
Oh, on a more consistent basis.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
A little bit of an edge there.
Yeah.
They almost went into kind of Nick Caserio mode almost. On a more consistent basis. Yes. I liked in the press conference what Stingley had said was that, you know, the team doesn't try to ask him to be somebody he's not, and that a lot of his leadership he thinks just comes from by setting an example of a guy that works really hard. You end up getting rewarded for it, and then being a good teammate. And being the teammate part, that's a fun one, and it's a little bit loaded here in Houston because of that era when Bill O'Brien first got here and almost every player was answering every question, I'm just trying to be the best teammate I can be. It was funny, especially with Arian Foster when he did it and he would only answer questions that way. But that was when it felt very much like Bill O'Brien was going to be heavy-handedly tell you that this is what you care about. You're going to care about the team. It's a lot better and it's a lot more fun when it comes from the players themselves. And certainly D'Amico talks about being a good teammate and all that stuff in his team meetings, but you got to have the right kind of guys that really feel that way. And it does feel in the defensive back meeting room that they've got the right kind of esprit de corps and respect for each other, that's when you get a synergistic effect almost, because guys are really communicating really well. And I thought the Texans back in 2011 and in that era where the defensive backs were playing very well, I was really impressed the first time I came back to Houston and got back out and watched those guys practice at how tight-knit the defensive backs were and how they really communicated really well. I think this defensive back room is, on the sum total of it all, more talented than that group from back then.
Yeah.
But also they need to have that mature ability to communicate really effectively.
Yep.
And I think they're on their way to having that.
I agree. Here was Derek Stingley Jr. They asked him about, this is something he didn't get asked about in the press conference, and it's probably a pretty underrated part of his game. He's a pretty good tackler. On his run defense and where that part of his game comes from.
Once I got into college, my defensive back coach, Corey Raymond, he would always say, y'all got to tackle. Y'all got to know how to tackle. Come down, make a tackle. You hit with this shoulder, this foot. forward, and he would just say that, and we would kind of look at him like, why, like, you know, like, what's the point of us really getting in there and tackling? But I mean, it turned out that, I mean, to be a better corner, you got to show up in the run. Like, you got to be reliable, or else they're just gonna run the ball at you 30 times a game, and that you're not gonna help the team if you can't make the tackles.
Go find me a clip of Jalen Ramsey saying anything close to that.
Yeah, exactly.
Jalen Ramsey has the Deion disease of thinking of himself as just like he's out there to cover people and nothing more. Except at least Deion was a little bit smaller, whereas Jalen Ramsey looks big. Like he should be able to tackle.
Yeah.
My most encouraging moment for Stingley when he was a young player was when they were playing the Titans. And Derrick Henry, in the first matchup versus the Titans, it was one of those years where they played him twice in 3 weeks. There was a play where Derek Stingley, really, his responsibility should have been to set the edge, force the play inside. A lot of times as a cornerback, you've got the force. That means, like, you got to turn the play back inside. If you're not responsible for making the tackle, be sure you turn the play back inside. And he screwed it up. This was either his rookie year or his second year. And it was like a classic. Like it looked like he was a little uncertain himself of how to operate it. And then 2 weeks later, they played the Titans again, and he just sold out. And just, like, whatever he did, he was going to force the play back inwards, back inside. But then he also made the play. He destroyed the guy who was trying to block him. And then he tackled Derrick freaking Henry. And that's when I saw, okay, there's something here, because there's a coachability element that he learned from. He got the coaching on it a couple weeks ago. He knew the game plan this week, and he not only held the force, but he actually made the actual play, which is above and beyond what you expect a cornerback to do on that side. And that's right. That was the first moment where I was like, okay, yeah, he really might. This is a kid that might really put it all together.
That was at the end of his second year, because that's when they played the Titans. They played with Case Keenum in Nashville in Week 15.
Yeah,
and then they played in the game where CJ came back from the concussion here in Week 17. So you're right. It was 2 weeks apart. It was at the end of the 2023 season where that. And I remember exactly what you're talking. Talking about it on this show. I remember exactly what you're talking about. All right, so John Harris has a favorite play. This actually wound up being, I think, we did a poll of Texan fans of their favorite offensive and defensive plays of the year, and I think this one won the favorite defensive play of the year in a landslide. I think it won by a wide margin. This was Derek Stingley Jr.'s second interception of Tua Tagovailoa in the win over Miami.
Third down and 5 at the Houston 20. Tua in the gun. Here's the snap. Tua, quick fire, right side, and intercepted by Stingley. He's got it across the 15 and wrestled out of bounds by Hill. Derek Stingley Jr., the INT. He turns back Miami. Okay, what a takeaway for the Texans. They've got the rock in a 20-12 lead with 10:26 to go in the fourth.
Yeah, that's not the right one. I think that one, that's not on you, Ben. That got attached to a show email from yesterday from somebody else. That was the first interception. It's nice when you have the wrong interception. That was the second interception, the one where he yanked the ball out of Tyreek Hill. Texan fans know what I'm talking about. We don't need the highlight.
Yeah, no, that one was a really I was going down and I was watching that play. I had to edit it for something, and at various still frames in that interception, there's no way in hell you think Stingley's going to have that interception.
Mm-hmm.
It was an underthrown ball. So, you know, if it was thrown with a little bit more loft, that's a reception by Tyreek Hill. But it was a genuine 50-50 ball, or maybe like a 70-30 ball for Stephon Diggs. But Stingley I think.
Tyreek Hill, you mean? Yeah.
For Tyreek Hill. Yeah. I think Stingley, because his ball tracking is so good, it wasn't like he was beat so bad and that's why he needed an underthrow ball to catch it. He timed the jump and tracked the ball just perfectly.
Yep.
And that's the thing that he does that has so many people when he was a younger guy saying, oh, maybe he should play wide receiver. It's really three notches above almost anything else you see from other defensive backs.
Derek Stingley Jr. does not say much, but when we asked him about those interceptions on the postgame show, he gave a really detailed breakdown where I'm sitting here listening. I'm going, this dude is smart. Like, he is very smart. And he broke down the interception that you just described, Seth, against Tyreek Hill on Texans All Access with John and Mark 2 days ago. Ben?
on that play, I think it was either the play before or the play or two plays before that, he ran, he took an outside release and ran a dig and he caught the ball for a first down. And the way he ran the route, it was kind of weird. Like, you're not going to see nobody else run that, how he runs it. So, all right. Anyway, so that's beforehand.
So that set it up in your brain of that set something up.
Right. And then either the next play or two plays after he caught that pass, it was kind of like the shot area going into the field. And I just had a thought in my mind that he wasn't going to try to just run past me right here, even though he could have, because we was in single high. They had a lot of field to work with, to like a front pylon throw or back pylon, whichever one they wanted. But he took the release and he stayed kind of vertical off his first couple steps. And then when he was running, like, he wasn't like Tyreek. He has a specific type of run and how he looks when he's running. I just had a feeling that he was about to break, and then I just kind of locked in on his hip, and then once he turned, I turned and looked for the ball. So.
That's the nuance that goes into being a really good cover corner. I've told you this a bunch of times. I really wish more cornerbacks were color commentators after they're done, because I guess the only problem might be that some of them, because they're so detailed and that stuff like that, that they don't have the time to really explain all of that during a game. But they understand the game, the passing game, on such a high level, more so than, and in some respects, more so than quarterbacks do, because they understand the nuances of the route running so well. And that's kind of like the football nerdiness side of Derek Stingley that you would never know from watching press conferences or anything. But you said it yesterday, when he breaks down the plays, it's really fun to listen to him talk, because he does that part of it really, really well. The other part about cornerbacks, when you hear guys talk that way, it's the confidence that it takes to kind of have hunches or thoughts about what a guy might do with their route running. Think about a batter at the plate, and anywhere other than with two outs in the ninth inning, largely it's still a personal battle between you and the pitcher, and that it's okay, I think he's going to throw a curve here because of this, that, and the other thing. But if you strike out or whatever, no big deal. A cornerback, you're playing that same mental game. But if you whiff, not only do you screw the team, but also it's embarrassing. Like, you get beat hard. A batter whiffing is not the most embarrassing thing in the world. A cornerback whiffing gets played on SportsCenter over and over and over again. And you got people on the internet saying, what are you thinking? What are you thinking here, Derek Stingley? So it takes a certain kind of confidence that it's hard to come by. Well, and obviously Stingley has a lot of confidence.
And that play he's describing there is against Tyreek Hill, who over the last three or four years, I think you make an argument over the last three or four years, he's the most valuable non-quarterback in the league. Maybe not so much last year because of how things went for Miami. But, I mean, that he's doing it against Tyreek Hill, and that he ripped it out of his hands, too, is just, I love that play. I absolutely love that play. Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line. Good morning, guys. I agree with Seth. If that mock drafter thinks Nick won't try to trade up or down in the first round, then he is short-sighted in his process.
Well, okay.
Nick is a wheeler dealer. If he has an eye on a player that's available, then they need to trade up a slot or two to get him.
I think in defense of mock drafters, I mean, trying to predict or forecast what trades are going to be, for the most part, by and large, you'll throw a couple of trades in there just for novelty's sake.
Right.
But unless it involves a quarterback where you can predict or you're hearing that a team's going to try to trade up for a quarterback, it's a worthless endeavor. Or, you know, like, so you almost kind of look at it like, okay, this makes sense here and there. So I don't, in defense of the mock drafter, I don't think that he thinks that Nick Caserio wouldn't trade.
Right.
It's just that Nick Caserio doesn't know what trade is going to be available on draft day.
Yeah. Or the mock drafter has the answers to the test like Daniel Jeremiah did back in 2023.
Yeah, Daniel Jeremiah he was so on the nose in predicting that the Texans would draft CJ Stroud and then trade up for Will Anderson. Daniel Jeremiah is a really smart guy, but he's also a very plugged-in guy. I feel like he probably had some advance notice on that. Yep. Especially, that was a mock draft that was published, I think, the day before the draft.
Yes.
So where we knew that Nick and the Cardinals had already been having conversations.
Yeah, the leaks were coming from the Cardinals side, if I had to guess on that one, to Daniel Jeremiah. Text message, at the end of the season, I saw an interview where Titus Howard commenting on the loss to Kansas City and the season in general and the state of the team and the offensive line. He talked about really working on his body and getting his body right, really coming back in top condition. So I think he knows he wasn't in the best shape and that there will be some changes. I got to tell you, by the end of the year, when I would see huddles around Titus Howard's locker with him talking, I just would scroll. I just got tired of listening to Titus this season for whatever reason. You know, like
really anybody on the offensive line.
Yeah,
they didn't want to hear anything about you guys are the biggest. Remember, we were saying
we're
that
accountable. They would make excuses all the time.
Like, do you guys understand how bad you are as a group? Mm-hmm. Do you guys really get it? Because you're right. It was a lot of excuses. Anytime, I mean, it's been a steady diet for years and years and years of both Laramie, but especially Titus on social media defending false starts.
Yeah.
I mean, Titus will just flat out go on social media and say, nah, it looks fine to me. Don't know why this was a penalty. People get tired of that. You get really, really sick of it when it's one of the worst units in the league and you guys are acting like you're the victims or something. Mm-hmm. That was hard to stomach. So, yeah. And a lot of that, I really don't want to have some kind of a witch hunt for Laramie Tunsil like he was the root of all evil or anything. But I do think that there was a tone in that offensive line room that wasn't going to be fixed by Laramie Tunsil's precedent, for example. Laramie, it took him, how many years did he spend in Houston?
Seven? Six seasons.
6 years in Houston. It took until midway through last year before he ever even looked like he felt bad about one of his penalties.
Yep.
I mean, it was excuse making when it came to the penalties over and over again.
What does that mock drafter that you guys were going through in the previous segment have the magnificent Gladstone doing in the draft? Glad you asked. He has them flip-flopping with the Jets, doing a trade with the Jets, trading down to 7. The Jets moving up and taking Travis Hunter. And the magnificent Gladstone, GM of the Jacksonville Jaguars, takes, behold, the 7th overall pick. The magnificent Gladstone takes Mason Graham, defensive tackle out of Michigan, with the 7th pick overall. Yeah,
nothing I love more than seeing a stud defensive tackle in the division, given what the Texans... Let's get that interior offensive line hemmed up, all right?
Let's
go ahead and just take care of that this year, please. Yeah. Yep. Please, I can't watch another playoff game where the interior offensive line can almost single-handedly.
All right, March Madness is underway, and we got, in my opinion, one of the greatest NIL stories in the NIL era that we're living in, and it doesn't even involve a player. We will share that with you coming up next.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
So we're one day into March Madness. For me, the tournament starts Thursday. The play-in games are what they are. To me, it starts 11:15 a.m., tip of the first game. This is when the highlights that will show up on One Shining Moment begin. And for the first day, it was fine. It was basketball. You know, there were some games that were competitive and close. We didn't get any iconic buzzer beaters. The biggest upsets we got were Drake beating Missouri, and McNeese State is probably the biggest story so far, beating Clemson. Because McNeese State's coach, Will Wade, might be leaving. Clemson's coach just signed like a 6-year extension. It was a 12 beating a 5. That happens every year, so on and so forth. But there haven't been any landmark kind of like, there's nothing like that we would replay in headlines today, Seth. Nothing like that so far. So probably the biggest, but the biggest face of the tournament so far, the one that kept popping up on my timeline last night. I couldn't go 3 tweets without the algorithm feeding me a video of Amir Khan, whose nickname is Aura. He's the manager. He's the student manager for the McNeese State basketball team. McNeese State, of course, over there in Lake Charles. And he has gone viral for essentially kind of copycatting a little bit the San Francisco 49ers of a few years ago, where they would have a manager, kind of a team equipment guy or whatever.
It's one of their assistant coaches or whatever, I think. Yeah, it was like a strength coach. They would go out with the boombox with the team.
Yeah.
I think he still does it, yeah.
Yeah, on his shoulder.
But it's a big deal, yeah. He's kind of dancing around and everything, yeah.
Yeah, so Amir Khan, the student manager, he's got the boombox with kind of a shoulder strap, and they pick a different song to go out to. And apparently, I forget what the song was, but they picked one game they were going out with it, and they picked a song, and he happened to know all the words. It was a rap song. And Amir Khan, it looks to be, looks to be about 19 or 20 years old.
Yeah.
And he looks,
yeah,
looks
he's
Indian.
He's kind of like a, just has a doughy, he's got big glasses. He's just, he's kind of a frumpy dude.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all, there's something about it that's, it's the,
contrast
of the basketball players who are all towering above him, and him just looking like a badass, like he's in a rap video or something, just owning it with a big boombox. But it looks, he's got it slung over his shoulder, like it's a computer bag or something,
right?
And it actually looks like he's almost struggling with the weight of it. But there's just a, there's something about it where you're like, I like this kid. I like this kid's confidence and swagger.
Yes, exactly. So. There was a point in the season where, and I put the wrong link in the article or in the rundown to the article, but it was a certain song, and the team was shocked that he knew all the words to it. He was just started bumping out there, and they knew all the words, so the team started going crazy. So this thing has taken on a life of its own to the point where he got an NIL deal during the season. Amir Khan did, the student manager, with a ticket app called TickPick. You know, it's like StubHub or SeatGeek or Game Time. It's in that realm. And he's actually got a deal with them where the further McNeese State goes in the tournament, the more money he gets from his NIL deal. Because in theory, he's going to be seen more out there,
right,
tweeting more. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
He has picked up a the NIL deals that he's gotten. There's three of them that have at least been mentioned. The first one was TickPick, and then when the legend of this kid started to pick up, Buffalo Wild Wings and Insomnia Cookies jumped on board. And they've got all, you know, this kid's like a NASCAR driver. He'll have a shirt on that maybe has the logo. The boombox for any given game has the logo of one of those companies on it. The legend of this kid and the amount of attention he's gotten, and McNeese State winning, so the attention gets dragged out for at least two more days. I don't know what they're paying this kid, but they're getting, I got to believe that they're starting to feel they're not getting their money's worth. They're trending in that direction right now for sure.
Yeah.
With this NIL. So this kid's getting a lot of money, Seth, as the student. He's the first ever student manager to get an NIL deal. I think that's just badass.
I feel like this is actually one of the really good things to come out of NIL.
Yes.
This is all it almost feels like, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a Ted Lasso element to it too, that maybe makes it even more that without people even realizing it, they've seen this before, where the equipment manager in Ted Lasso ends up becoming a coach and respected for all of his contributions.
What the hell was his name? Nathan. Was it Nathan?
Nathan. I don't know, whatever his name was. He ended up being a villain, right? I stopped watching that series.
Yes.
But it almost feels like, oh, he's getting his due. You know, he's a part of the team.
Yeah.
And look, the companies feel they can monetize that and use his publicity. I like it. I like it. I don't worry about this kid leaving in the transfer portal.
Right.
I don't worry about him leaving for the NBA. He might end up, as long as McNeese State is relevant in any given year, he should stay around and do his grad work at McNeese State.
Yes.
He should maybe become an associate professor. He needs to stick around and ride this thing out for as long as he can, as opposed to being a human resources manager or whatever he's majoring in.
I think it's great, man. I think it's great. And I'm debating right now, actually, whether to read the tweet that I got in response to this morning.
Why are you debating it?
Well, I'm
I told you to do it.
Let me finish.
Oh, okay.
I'm debating whether to do it now or save it for Take a Mania at the top of the hour. Because the take that I got, the take that I saw about this video, there's a video of Amir Khan walking out down the runway with the boombox and the players going crazy and mentioning his NIL deals. And there is there's a bitter person online who thinks that this is the final straw that broke the camel's back that makes college sports the worst thing in the world.
This is all that's wrong with college sports these days.
Yeah.
No, we can save that for Take a Mania.
Save it for Take a Mania at the top of the hour. I'll do that because it's a really poor take. And I responded to him as well. So good for him, man. You know what I'm finding with this tournament, Seth? I'm feeling it more acutely than ever. It feels like now for casual fans, and I skew way more towards a casual college basketball fan now than I do a diehard college basketball fan. The regular season is just so meaningless. You know, other than watching the Cougs, which I do, I like watching the Cougs and going to games is fun. But in terms of like sitting down on a Tuesday night and saying, okay, it's the best use of my time to sit here and watch Kansas and Baylor. You know, it's just that kind of thing. I don't anymore. But I think it's, for the casual fan, it seems like it's more about the coaches than it is the players. Like, those are the matchups that get people. Like, the fact that Calipari and Rick Pitino are going to be playing each other tomorrow is a really big deal. The fact that Bill Self gets knocked out by Calipari last night is a big deal. Yeah. I think for a lot of people, they're going, wow, Kelvin Sampson against Mark Few, two of the best coaches who've never won a national championship. That's who's going against each other. And even the coaching stories like Will Wade from McNeese State, it feels like his biggest story with McNeese State as the upset of Clemson is the fact that he's supposedly taking the NC State job, and that's looming over the team right now. Almost like the coaches are the big story more so than any of these players.
And they've graced us with many sound bites during the regular season.
That's why they're so entitled at press conferences. Out. Yes.
Yeah, but I like that. They can bring some drama to it. Did we have any coaching meltdowns yesterday?
We didn't. And I was really Utah State played UCLA in a late game, too late for me to stay up for. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to stay up for this just to root for Utah State so I can wake up to some surly Mick Cronin quotes. But UCLA was up by like 20 in the second half, and I'm like, all right, I can go to bed.
I didn't, because that game was such a non-contest yesterday for the Cougs, I didn't watch any of Kelvin Sampson's comments afterwards. We probably should be, at the very least, finding, after each one of these games, finding the crustiest comment from Kelvin Sampson.
Yes.
Because there's something about just old school, crusty, downplaying this or getting perturbed about that. We need to be sure that that's in our veins 24/7 as long as Houston remains in the tournament.
That's a really good suggestion.
That kid is a sports management major.
Okay.
So this is actually, the great thing about this is not only is he going to get NIL money out of it, but he's probably going to be able to dupe his way into 3 extra credits just by, he can do an independent study, a thesis about his experience with all of this and how he monetized it and everything.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe teach, be a TA in a class or something.
He's a walking thesis right now is what he is.
Which these days, I know 3 credits is probably worth, what, about $78,000?
Yeah.
Did you pay for a summer session lately?
No Damn kidding. It. Yeah. Oh, did you have to pay for a summer session?
I paid for a summer session.
Oh. Yeah, that's tough. The overseas credits, those will get you too.
It was an anthropological.
Right. Yeah.
Course in, where the hell was it?
Barbados.
Yeah.
Yeah. No problem.
I need you.
Tell you what your kid's up to.
Can I bring you in on phone calls with my child?
Yes.
And have you just muted, but you can text me. Funny. Text me and remind me of what I'm supposed to remember.
You and I are just going to do a trade. I think my sons like texting with you more than they like texting with me.
The Barbados side of it was cheaper than the Eugene part of the normal school
year. Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah, it was actually way cheaper and easier to get into Barbados than it is to get into Eugene. Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. 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 If you ever had a kid that goes to Oregon, just know.
You're going to see a lot of the vast wilderness of, well, not really. You'll see a nice drive along the interstate up to Portland and Seattle as you try to figure out how you're going to fly into Eugene.
Yeah, exactly. Or, yeah, massive 4-figure dollar amounts for your flights into Eugene. Do you think the players on McNeese's team are jealous? That's a text to the Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line. No, I don't. It's amazing how much the players on this team love this guy. That's what jumped out.
They'd be jealous. They'd be jealous if it were back in the day and they weren't allowed to make money.
Correct.
But all of a sudden the manager is getting these big paydays and checks and everything. Then they'd be jealous.
No.
But I'm guessing the amount of money that the average starter makes in basketball and football right now. I mean, in football, I don't know if this has changed at all, but I know going into last season, they said the average NIL deal for a starting player on a Power 5 conference, like $200,000.
That's what I saw,
too. I mean, that's without any kind of glitz attached to it or anything.
Yep.
So, you know, I'd be very surprised if anybody's jealous.
No, I saw several interviews with Amir Khan yesterday. I saw they did an interview with him in the locker room after the game, and one of the players came over wearing gear from one of the companies that is endorsing Amir Khan. And the interviewer who was interviewing Amir Khan turns to the player and says, hey, what is it about this guy, Amir, blah, blah, blah. And the player's like, this is his interview, not my interview. You talk to him. They love him. They absolutely love him. It's awesome.
Well, speaking of social media enhancing the athletes, like Livy Dunn's boyfriend, Paul Skeens, the pitcher for the Pirates. Did you see the story about his limited edition card that went up for auction? It was it went up for I think it sold for $1 million.
Okay.
And the Pirates at one point had tried to buy it with a package that was it was seats behind home plate for 30 years, but it was for the Pirates. And and one of and Libby Dunn was part of the package where she would have watched a game with you. Yeah. The kid that owned the card, the kid that found the card was a 9-year-old. Yeah. I'm like, "Oh man, If he were 4 or 5 years older, that Libby Dunn, the Libby Dunn guest suite appearance
sold.
Might have been, yeah.
You get prima nocta over Libby Dunn.
Yeah, but they put it, Jesus. But, I mean, people wondered if at least part of the appeal, aside from Paul Skeens being a very good young baseball player, Paul Skeens is making less money this year than the 9-year-old who auctioned off the card.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Skeens is making like $900,000 and the kid auctioned off the card for $1 million plus.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Seats at that stadium, the Pirates stink, but that is an awesome stadium.
Yeah.
That stadium in Pittsburgh, if you're ever near Pittsburgh during baseball season and the Pirates are at home, go. It is an awesome, awesome stadium.
It's a really cool city just for watching any of the three major sports that they have.
Yes.
Because it's this downtown environment, but Pittsburgh's a really small city, and it's all packed into this valley right there at the confluence of those three rivers, however they describe it.
Yeah.
And we went to watch an NHL playoff game there once. The Penguins were playing the Devils, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a huge NHL fan or anything, but just the environment and going to the bars before and after the game and everything, it was really,
it's
really
amazing.
Cool.
You know, Amy and I went to a Penguins game in December when we went for that Steelers game. I've been to all three arenas there and been downtown a lot. It is an underrated city. It really is.
It was always my favorite place to play just because of that too. There's just a different feel to the Steelers fans themselves.
It's great.
Like the environment is like, it's very, even with their new stadium, their game day experience, it's just all about football. There's no so cheerleaders good. Or anything. And it's just a really cool environment.
So good. So good. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you. All right. The Astros get going Thursday of next week. So decision time is coming up here. For Dana Brown, what do we feel like he's leaning towards right now with Cam Smith? And are the Astros starting pitchers getting disrespected? I think they might be. We'll explain coming up next.
Live from the Mokarem Injury Lawyer Studios, Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Payne and Pendergast, good to be with you on a Friday. Hope you got a lot of basketball watching in your future. Games get going at 11:15. You can hear every game. I think I heard a promo. You can hear every game on the Odyssey app. It's pretty badass. And we're playing a lot of the games at nighttime here. You can hear a bunch of the games on our sister station, 650. So we've got you covered here for the NCAA basketball tournament. Quoting a great franchise builder, a great roster constructor, quote, "Make no mistake, I'm not afraid to put this guy in the big leagues," end quote. Who is that person? Who is it that I just quoted right there?
You just quoted Dana Brown.
I did. You're right. I quoted Dana Brown, Astros GM. I'm the one messing. It's my microphone set.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was hitting the wrong button.
I got nervous because you were asking me a question that typically I ask you questions. I'm the one that gets names screwed up for no good reason at all.
I knew you'd get this one right, though.
Yeah, and then it looked like you might be having a stroke because I couldn't hear what you were saying.
That's
okay,
good.
Okay. Yeah. So it was Dana Brown.
Dana Brown.
Who I know, Sean, is the general manager of the Houston Astros.
You know,
okay?
Yeah.
Not to flex on all my vast sports knowledge or anything, but Dana Brown, he ain't scared. He ain't yellow, okay?
No.
He ain't yellow.
We'll find out.
Oh, yeah, maybe he's just all hat, no cattle.
When he talks about
how he ain't scared.
Yes, yes.
And where are we on our Are You Yellow segment? Our listeners have been demanding that.
Yeah. Here's the thing with the Are You Yellow segment. It feels like, whereas with the bad takes, you know there's going to be those every week.
Yeah.
With Acknowledge Me, you know you're going to get performances you can highlight there. Are you yellow? Do we get enough yellow people in a given time to where we know we've got enough for a segment
every
week?
No, because all it has to be is, it's not about making fun of people or anything. It's about us demanding what we want.
Yeah.
So it could be 5 minutes where it's something that we want. We want to see Cam Smith on the opening day roster.
Gotcha.
Hey, what's the matter, Dana Brown?
Okay.
Are you yellow?
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
So now,
yeah, stuff like that.
I've actually bookmarked a few instances on YouTube where I've got people saying in movies and TV shows, are you yellow? Some version
All right,
of
good.
That. Okay.
So now here's the thing. I don't think Dana Brown is yellow.
I don't think he is either.
And there's a part of me, too, where I feel like, all right, look, if Dana Brown doesn't want to bring him up, then I trust. Dana Brown might be the GM in baseball most where you wouldn't call him yella and or that he's scared of bringing up a guy. He'll do it very quickly. He's not afraid to advance guys through. So I think we're at the point where I do trust Dana Brown to use his discretion about whether he thinks it's a good idea or not to bring up Cam Smith. I'll still be upset about it's still also ultimately Dana Brown who's responsible for having three gigantic question marks in your outfield right this moment.
Yes.
You've got a rookie, a 35-year-old rookie in left field. You've got a vast
defensively
minus at
a rookie,
plate,
yes, for sure,
in center field.
Yep.
And then potentially a very promising rookie in right field.
Mm-hmm.
But because Chaz McCormick just has not been anything fun to watch over the last year.
Yeah. Yes. So we'll see what happens, man. We'll know within the next few days what the future holds for Cam Smith. You know what? Screw it. I'm hoping they put him on the big league roster. Developmental issues or service time issues where they don't get the extra. I'm here for excitement in April and Cam Smith. A Cam Smith at bat would be second only to a Yordan Alvarez at bat in terms of the must see at bats in this lineup. At least early on.
Right. I think in terms of just sheer novelty, opening day is going to be a whole lot of fun because you're going to see Altuve in left field. Most likely. I mean, Espada has said he's going to spend most of his time in left field. I don't know if maybe early in the season they start him at second base just to keep him comfortable. I don't know.
I think it's a lock.
Yeah. I mean, he's not going to be a defensive specialist in left field who comes in like Jake Mariznick at the end of games. So you've got that. You've got potentially Cam Smith playing. You've got the new additions from the trade in Paredes and Wisniewski.
Wisniewski, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got Walker at first base. Walker looks like he's going to be healthy and good to go.
Yep.
There's a lot of fresh and new things to get excited about and or nervous about.
Yeah.
Cam Smith, though, if Cam Smith making errors in right field, you think, okay, he's 22 years old, he's a rookie, it's a new position change to him. The Jose Altuve errors in left field is the one where it's just not as simple or as easy for me to think, like, well, that's simple and he'll get that figured out, just because it's one of those things that you can make a case for it being simple, and yet it's also something that very rarely happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you really genuinely don't know if it's simple or not.
Yep.
Intellectually, it seems like it should be simple, but the life is rife with things that you expect to be simple, and then all of a sudden your kids are 3, 5, and 7 years old, and you hate life.
Yeah. Yes.
What could be so hard about parenting? You spend your whole young adulthood being like, I don't know why these parents whine and complain so much.
Yeah.
Seems pretty simple to me. All you got to do is give them some discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not simple at all.
Fast forward 10 years later, you're just thinking about buying a one-way ticket to Mexico City.
Both of my sons listen. He's not talking about you guys, just so you know, all right?
Not publicly.
Not publicly. So Framber Valdez is going to start opening day. 4 straight years he started opening day. Should we be nervous about the Astros pitching? I know it's not the level that it was when it was at its peak, when you had Verlander and Cole and Greinke and Keuchel when he was good, and then Framber and Verlander, and then McCullers was mixed in there, and so on, and Javier when he was doing his thing and all that. Should we be nervous about this? And here's why I ask. The Athletic did a poll of 20 different talent evaluators, scouts, people in that realm, people involved in player development, and they did it empirically where they asked them to give scores to several dozen starting pitchers around baseball,
yeah,
and they put them into tiers. Tier 1, the inner circle, the unanimous number one starters. Tier 2, aces, scores between 90 and 99.5. Tier 3, doorstep knockers, guys who might be aces one day. So I get to there, and I'm feeling like, okay, well, I'm scrolling on this article. I'm like, all right, well, we should be to Framber Valdez at least by now, if not Framber and Hunter Brown.
Yeah.
Framber Valdez is a tier four in this article, a number two and number three starter. Hunter Brown is a number four and number five in tier five. You believe that?
Wait a minute. No. I don't. No, that's weird about Framber. What do they call him?
He is a tier four starter. Those with lower ceilings but elevated floors. It should be noted, these guys are still awesome at baseball. But they're basically saying that they're not aces. They're number two or number three starters. Framber Valdez has more wins than anybody in the American League over the last 4 years.
I don't understand that.
These are bad talent evaluators, Seth.
I don't get that at all.
Yeah.
That's very strange.
Yep.
This feels a little to me like that time. Remember in 2015 when the Astros started? No, 2017. Was it the year they started hitting all the home runs was 2000?
That was even. That might have been 14.
17 was when they became polished.
Yeah.
Because there was a scout that was interviewed towards the end of the season where he said, the Astros now they strike out too much. And the person doing the interview of this anonymous scout said, actually, they're the best in they have the lowest amount of strikeouts in the league.
Yeah.
And the scout said, I don't believe that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Framber Valdez is a tier four starter.
Here's what they say. Valdez just does his thing. You like grounders? This is the guy for you. He puts the ball on the ground and puts the ball on the ground and puts the ball on the ground.
Yeah.
Since he joined the Astros rotation in 2020, he's put up a 3.12 ERA and received Cy Young votes in four separate seasons. Can he maintain this into his mid-30s, one scout asked. If history is any guide, some team besides the Astros will pay to find out the answer. That does not feel like you're describing somebody who should be a tier four in this exercise.
I think also in describing his career ERA, it's interesting to me that they use his career ERA, in which the last several years of his career have been markedly different than the first part of his career.
Yeah.
Like when he figured out the psychological side of things, he became a much different pitcher. Yeah. But his consistency has been his calling card really since then. When you start talking to scouts, it's funny though, because I think a lot of them have photographic memories and they remember the way they evaluated Framber Valdez and what he was like as a young player. And I feel like we still feel that in the fan base to a certain degree. I think that sometimes people, myself included at times, psychologically, you almost don't acknowledge how consistent he's been because the first impression was so inconsistent.
Yeah.
So, no, those guys can all go die. Those guys should all be fired immediately for disrespect to Framber Valdez.
I feel more disrespect in Framber being in tier four than I do Hunter Brown in tier five.
I'm cool with that. Because Hunter Brown, look
half a good season.
Right. He's had great a very, season. Very promising ever since he started throwing a sinker and made another couple tweaks. I get that.
Yep.
And I understand looking at the sum total of that. He's still a young pitcher. It was like, you know, Javier had the year where he was one of the best starting pitchers in the league. But when it came time for him to be a full-time starting pitcher, it's a whole different challenge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get that. I don't. That seems like extreme disrespect to Framber.
I couldn't believe it. I was taken aback scrolling because they start at tier five in the article and count upwards. I was taken aback that I found Hunter Brown in that article so early. Right?
Yeah.
I was shocked when Framber popped up in tier four. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. All right. Take a mania. We do it every Friday at 9:00. The worst takes that we've heard or read this week. Still trying to take down the champ. Angelo Cataldi is on a run here. He is still for 6 weeks now with his take on Andy Reid, the longtime Philadelphia radio host, been the champion. Has anybody said anything stupid enough to take down the stupidity of Angelo Cataldi? We will discuss and find out coming up next.